Thank you. Nice and on time.
Good morning, everyone. I am officially opening today's Revenue Committee hearing. Under discussion today will be a host of bills related to capital gains, but first we have some business of the committee. So I am going to open a work session on Senate Bill 306. Christine, you want to remind us?
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 306 would, as amended, would extend the opportunity to hold special elections to form a new taxation district with a permanent rate limit, and it would extend these opportunities to May and November elections of even years or odd years as well as even years. Previously, it was just even years under current statute.
If you recall our discussion from yesterday, committee members, we did not have a fiscal impact statement, so we couldn't move this bill. We have before you a fiscal impact statement. Did we move the amendments yesterday?
No. Okay. No, we didn't do anything. We didn't open the work session.
Oh, well, we have a work session open right now, and we have an amendment. Mr. Chair?
Madam Chair, I move the A4 amendment to the Senate Bill 306.
Chair Barnhart moves the A4 amendment to Senate Bill 306. Any objection? So ordered. Mr. Co-Chair.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 306 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barnhart moves Senate Bill 306 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any comments? Any objection?
Yes. I would simply note that it took a while, but we finally got it all yesterday at our hearing.
Yes, we...
And I'm now satisfied that this thing is ready to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that we've worked this thing maybe to death, but I think we're there at this point. So thank you very much.
Madam Chair, let us hope so.
Any objection to the motion?
I can't answer a question about May versus November.
Yes.
No, thank you.
Speak now, Representative. Okay. We move the bill to the floor with a due pass. Do we have a anyone who would like to carry? Representative Brewer.
I will volunteer to save Representative Reed.
Okay. Representative Air Brewer will carry the bill. Thank you, committee members, and I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 306. Committee members, today we are going to hear a number of bills, and they have a relation to capital gains taxation in Oregon. We have both specific proposals and general discussion. And so we're going to start with an informational discussion about the subject of capital gains, and I'm going to ask Chris to sort of set the table for us.
Good morning, members of the committee. In your packet, you have a handout entitled House Bills Affecting Capital Gains Taxation, and on it, there's, I'm just going to walk through this relatively quickly, but just under current law, capital gains, generally speaking, for Oregon, don't receive special treatment. They're just thrown into the pot and they're taxed at the regular marginal rates. In terms of policies to implement some sort of preferential treatment for capital gains, there can be categorized into broad policy options and narrow policy options. And a broad policy option would be some sort of general rate reduction or a specific tax rate. And you have some examples in the bills before you today. Or there could be a full or partial exclusion or subtraction from the tax. And the difference, there are some administrative differences between applying a different tax rate versus a subtraction. But generally speaking, that would apply to all capital gains regardless of their nature. Then you have, on the other extreme, narrow policy options. And those could be a preferential treatment for investments in certain types of entities or for a certain type of or time period or special circumstances. A couple that I have listed here are what I've labeled a rollover or retirement option or a time period. A rollover might be if there's an investment, if gains are realized from the sale of one business if it's rolled over into another business. It could be exempt or from tax, or there could be a deferral. A retirement option might be the circumstance where somebody has started a small business and have that business has grown over 10, 20, 30 years and they want to retire, and then in those circumstances, the capital gains could be exempted from tax. And again, and anywhere in between are the policy options that can be discussed, from the very narrow to the very broad. The on the back of this sheet, by way of background, there is a the top bar chart shows the history of net capital gains taxes from 1986 through 2008, 2009, and then the forecast. The blue bars are the historical numbers, and the red bars are what we expect under the current law forecast. And so generally, start from 86 to about 92 into the mid-90s, it was relatively flat. But since 1996, you can see where we've been on the roller coaster ride of capital gains. It marched steadily upward through 2000 through the tech bubble. And then when that burst, it fell for 01 and 02. And then it started ramping up again and very quickly, about through 07, and then crashed in 08. And under the current law forecast, we're expecting it to get up to the 07 level in about 2014, and then staying up there. But
Representative Reed has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I know the answer to this, but the bar chart is Oregon only. Is that right?
Correct, Representative Reed. Those are from Oregon full-year tax returns.
Thank you.
So that presents certain challenges in forecasting and crafting some policy. The bottom charts are for the U.S. This is data from the IRS, and they do an occasional study of what kind of gains show up on the Schedule D, what kind of gains get reported. And the years I have here are 1999 and 2007. And it is kind of a sporadic time period, but 2007 is the most recent they have available. And putting these into categories, in 1999, we can see that of the gains, of the net gains that were realized, 43% were corporate stock, about 11% were real estate, both residential and business real estate property, and then 25% were pass-through entities, and that is a capital gain realized by an S corporation or a partnership that then gets taxed at the individual level. So that category, we actually don't know exactly from the tax return data, we don't know exactly what kind of gain that was. We don't know if the partnership sold some sort of corporate stock that it had or real property that it had. When it shows up on the tax return, there's just one category that it gets reported from the K-1. The shareholder or the partner gets a K-1 and says this is their capital gains and this is what gets reported there. So from that macro level, we don't know what kind of...
Yes.
Thank you. Do you have any indication, first off, if they're tracking, they can track what the pass-through entity is filing, but they're not, because that requires them to look down. But
That was an editorial comment.
That was. Thank you, Madam Chair. But the pass-through entity capital gains, is there any indication that you've seen out there that says that the pass-through entity gains would mirror the breakup of the other gains? Is there any type of analogy?
I haven't seen anything to point that direction. That would be my default assumption, that it would mirror the rest of the distribution.
Okay, thank you.
Well,
that would be my assumption. I don't...
Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
Well, if I could sort of follow up on that, I mean, it seems to me that's pretty important when you try to figure out where capital gains are coming from. A related question, if I may. Do we know, if we look at corporate stock, for example, 25%, do we know how much of that has to do with Oregon corporations doing business in Oregon and how much of it has to do with interstate, multi-state international corporations doing a business in Oregon, partly, and how much is it related to capital gains of corporations not doing business in Oregon? And do we have any idea?
Unfortunately, we don't. These data are U.S.
Right.
We don't have.
And then the other question I should have asked before, if I may.
Yes.
And that is, how closely does Oregon track this pie chart for the U.S.?
barring other specific information, the kind of default assumption would be that we mirror that, although that is, as I described, a default assumption.
On the other hand,
it could be very different, and that's one of the things we're struggling with. And for Oregon only, the information that we get from the IRS is just a couple of bottom lines. It's very limited. It's short-term gains and long-term gains, not the individual pieces. Having said that, with the electronic data, we do get everything on the Schedule D. It's all of that detail. And so the Department of Revenue is undertaking, they've been looking at it for a while, and as more and more people file electronic returns, we have more information, so the potential to get these data for Oregon gets better. And currently, I think Oregon filers are up to over 60% electronic now. And so as more and more people file electronic, the Department of Revenue is currently undertaking a project where they can sample the electronic data, the electronic returns, drill down into the Schedule D and try to put this together and then see if they can map that or make some sort of representation. The question there is of not only sample size, but whether or not electronic returns are sufficient to represent the population as a whole.
Mm.
And so they are currently taking that. And in my last conversation with DR, it looks like they can get a reasonable estimate for the total capital gains from looking at the electronic returns. The question will then be, do the capital gains on the electronic returns for corporate stock sufficiently represent the universe for Oregon, and as well as for each of the categories, the mutual funds, the capital gains distributions? And so that is currently being, that's actively being looked at in the Department of Revenue. And the key there is the electronic return data.
Could I follow up?
Yes.
Isn't it true, though, that when people file paper returns in Oregon, the department gets a copy of the federal return? Or is that old data and that no longer happens?
The department gets a copy of the 1040. They don't get the schedules.
So therefore, they don't know what companies were sold, if it was stock, to generate a capital gain, because while they're listed on the federal return, we don't get a copy of that.
Right. And historically, the Department of Revenue is in a data exchange program with the IRS, and they do get some information from the Schedule D, but they don't get all of the detail. They get, or just a couple of items from the Schedule D. They get like net short-term gain or loss and net long-term gain and loss.
Yeah, and may I just say, the reason I'm asking all these questions is that I'm interested in understanding what the efficiency is, would be, in terms of economic development, of a differential rate for capital gains. And it seems to me, and I could be wrong about this, but it seems to me that if what we're doing is reducing the tax on a gain generated in Tennessee, it's pretty inefficient from the standpoint of Oregon economic development. If we are reducing a capital gain on a stock from an Oregon corporation that does business in Oregon and hires employees in Oregon, then to the extent that a difference in marginal rate has an effect on economic development, which I think is still an open question, but assuming that it does, then it may have more efficiency in terms of economic development as a tax strategy. But without knowing these numbers, I don't know how we can possibly know the answer to any of these questions. That's why I ask. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two thoughts. One is, Chair Barnhart, I respectfully disagree. the reason why is I would even say when we have a resident or a taxpayer of any entity choice that recognizes a gain on corporate stock, let's say, and it's an out-of-state corporation, that means there's a disposal of that stock happening out-of-state, and it's only taxed in Oregon because it's an Oregon taxpayer. We are happy to take that gain and do something with it here. If they're not an Oregon taxpayer, ostensibly the cash is not available in Oregon to have reinvestment. If it's an Oregon business that's sold, potentially what's going on with that, we don't know. And to me, that is less of a factor for Oregon reinvestment purposes and benefiting from it. But for the benefit of the committee, I want to explain something about corporate stock in this pass-through entity and this orange other
factor. When an entity that is a corporation is sold, they can legally sell the stock, but for tax purposes, treat it as an asset sale. So when we have a company that is sold and capital gain is triggered, if it's sold as a stock, in all likelihood, it will be capital gain income. But if it's sold as an asset sale, we look through the corporation into the assets. Some of them will be taxed as ordinary income, and some of the assets will be taxed as capital. And that's why it's important. This green and orange is also very important to figure out when we have a company that sells. It may not be a corporate stock in this blue quadrant here. It may actually result in capital gains, but fit into some of these other ones. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Representative Warren,
and as a matter of fact, when you're talking about closely held business sales, oftentimes there are liability reasons to do an asset sale and not to do a stock sale.
Yeah.
Yes. You got more?
I was just going to point out along that line in 2007, the largest change there is the part that gets reported on the K-1s. It's the pass-through entity piece that dramatically grew in 2007.
And for my edification, K-1 is a schedule?
It's a schedule that pass-through entities generate to the shareholder or partner in a pass-through entity.
Okay, thank you. I thought that was correct. I just wanted it on the record. Thank you. Any further questions of Chris? I would like to invite Representative Lindsay and his guest to come forward at this time. They have some specific suggestions around capital gains that they'd like to put forward, if you would.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and colleagues. For the record, my name is Representative Sean Lindsay, State Representative, House District 30, Silicon Forest. And I noticed that Representative Juan took off right when I came up. I'll talk to him later. So my wife and I, we just recently came back. We were driving back to Oregon from being out of state, and we saw the great sign, welcome to Oregon, enjoy your stay. And we looked at each other, and we kind of laughed, and we said, that's kind of emblematic of the business climate right now here in Oregon. And it unfortunately mirrors the tax policy as well. We heard it all throughout the campaigns, our campaigns, gubernatorial campaign. Oregon has the highest capital gains tax in the nation. So what happened was both gubernatorial candidates addressed it. All tons of us legislators ran here to legislative council presenting ideas, and I think there's a whole bunch of capital gains tax reduction proposals in the mill here in the queue. Our specific bill number will not be addressed today. We'll just address the legislative concept of it, but the bill number is on its way to this committee. So what did I do? I started reading through all these concepts and scratching my head a little bit and saw those more complicated than I envisioned. And so I got thinking, boy, if I just knew a guru tax person, a nerdy tax person maybe, that would be great to visit with that person. So I looked upstairs at my own law firm and went and visited with my colleague at Lane Powell, Neil Kimmelfield, Harvard graduate, one of the best tax attorneys on the West Coast, I dare say. And so I visited with him. He helped prepare a great skeletal outline. And I also visited with my neighboring Representative Brewer, who co-sponsored the bill that's on its way. And I'd just say that the primary point of our proposal is that it includes safeguards to prevent taxpayers from misapplying the benefit. The proposal includes rules enabling taxpayers to make qualifying investments to reorganize their businesses without losing their tax benefits. And with that said, I'll let Mr. Kimmelfield explain a little bit better our proposal.
Thank you, Representative Lindsay.
Mr. Kimmelfield, welcome to the committee. We just ask that you state your name first, and we're anxious to hear you.
Co-Chair Berger and Co-Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Neil Kimmelfield. I'm an attorney with Lane Powell in Portland. And I just want to make clear that I'm speaking on my personal behalf and not on behalf of the law firm or any clients.
The origin of my involvement in this is a conversation I had with Representative Lindsey when we were talking about the press accompanying the capital gains issue. And I pointed out that there were editorials I had seen that talked about the importance of doing something about high capital gain rates in order to attract investment capital to Oregon. And I pointed out that individuals who do not reside in Oregon are, for the most part, not paying Oregon taxes on their capital gains from Oregon investments. The other point that I discussed with Representative Lindsey was the fact, similar to what Chair Barnhart referred to, that an across-the-board rate reduction would apply to investments by Oregonians in activities outside the state. It might apply to investments in long-held real estate that may or may not have produced a significant amount of economic development activity. And we talked about whether it would be desirable to craft something for purposes of advancing the discussion that focused on an economic development stimulus for Oregon. And the bill that's on its way is an attempt to do that. And the concept of the bill is that there would be effectively a reduction in rate in the form of a subtraction from federal taxable income with respect to gains realized from dispositions of post-2010 investments in Oregon business entities that resulted in capital gain income for federal purposes. And the bill includes a fairly complex definition, which we tax professionals like to see, because at least we have certainty. We can argue about whether it's appropriate, correct or not, but at least we know what the contours of the proposal are. So there is a definition of a qualified business in terms of the amount of services that are performed by the employees of the business in Oregon. There is a requirement that more than 50% of the property be used in a business to avoid applying this to passive investments in real estate. As the Representative Lindsey mentioned, there are what we describe as safeguards, which are rules that prevent taxpayers from stuffing appreciated assets into business entities to cause this benefit to apply to gains that relate to investments that have nothing to do with what the proposal is all about. There are rules built into this that enable taxpayers to reorganize their businesses without causing them to fail the definitional requirements. This is really intended to illustrate that when we try to target a benefit, it becomes very complicated. It creates opportunities for abuse. It creates opportunities to fail, to inadvertently to satisfy the requirements. And this is an attempt to answer a lot of those questions. And with that, do you have any questions?
Yes, Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for looking directly at me.
Yeah. anticipated that you would.
Well, what I wanted to do for the record was congratulate Representative Lindsey with gratefulness to Mr. Kimmelfield for offering the most complicated bill I've ever seen, even more complicated than any that I've seen Representative Bailey submit. And so I just wanted to put that on the record. And I think it has great merit. I looked through it. It did hurt my head looking through it. It is rather heavily relies on definition, something that needs to be explored. I don't agree wholly with your comments, Mr. Kimmelfield, on some aspects, but if we get the opportunity to look at the actual bill here in committee, would love to look through some of those things because it does have some good merit.
Yeah, Representative Reed, you have
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's actually what I was going to ask. If there is a specific bill, it's not amongst the ones that are in front of us
that
now.
Is that correct?
Okay.
That is correct. It is on its way.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, we have a little bit of a procedural issue here with a bunch of bills that are coming our way, but we can talk about the subject of capital gains. Mm-hmm. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Perhaps just a comment on the subject of reinvestment and how we use the tax code for reinvestment. I appreciate the idea of bringing forward a bill, although it's hard to comment on a bill without actually being able to see it. I'm looking forward to that. The idea of how we look at reinvestment in Oregon businesses, and certainly no new subject to this committee. As you'll recall, last session we had a bill on how we reinvest severance pay into Oregon businesses and then have a way to take that off the taxes. And recently had a constituent coffee, Madam Chair, at a small business in my district that is taking advantage of that particular portion to get started after being laid off. So there's certainly worth the concept of how we invest in Oregon businesses. I think the question will be in the details for sure.
Yes, thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is this, that is it, you explained how no matter what we do, clever folks are going to try to use the device. And really clever folks paid really big money to figure it out. So my question is, given the choices we have, one which would be a across-the-board reduction for all types of capital gains or a targeted device, is there a way, in your opinion, as one who practices in this area, to design a device that isn't going to be gamed, or are we merely creating more work for all of us in trying to figure out whether it's actually achieving the benefit that we all hope? And I ask that broad question first, and then I'll have a follow-up.
Thank you, Representative Vance. There are at least two questions embedded in that, and I will address the first question, which I'm not really capable of addressing, is whether it, because of gaming possibilities and complexity, it is more desirable to have something simpler like an across-the-board rate reduction. And that has to do more with what kinds of incentives it creates for people and whether there is efficiency in the way it creates those incentives. And I think that I'm not sure that that issue relates to the question about whether it's possible to construct something that will work as intended. My own thoughts about this are that the proposal that we have constructed is probably not prone to significant abuse, if any. As a technical matter, I think it works quite well, and it has safeguards built into it to prevent taxpayers from abusing it. The concerns, however, which I think are legitimate and should be discussed, are whether taxpayers will improperly purport to abuse it in ways that the Department of Revenue will not catch. That is a problem at the federal level, a problem at the state level. Even if a provision in the tax law is designed properly, taxpayers may apply it improperly. And the question is, as you make things more complex, do you invite them to do that? And is it possible for the department to administer it? And then along that latter point, the Department of Revenue may legitimately not be very happy with a proposal like this, because unlike complex provisions in the federal tax code, which Oregon follows, the IRS is not going to be taking the first crack at an audit of taxpayers. This is going to fall squarely on the shoulders of the Department of Revenue. And I think there are ways of minimizing that problem by doing things we have not put in the bill at this point, such as requiring taxpayers to provide explanations and schedules to support their conclusions. The department may never look at them, but there is an interim effect and having to provide a lot of detailed information with the return. The accountants are much less apt to advise taxpayers to take a flyer on abuse if they know that they have to prepare schedules that will be provided to their clients under their names and submitted to the department.
There's no doubt about our concern about accountants.
And attorneys.
Thank you.
I guess the question we're all struggling with is whether the work is worth the reward and how we measure whether or not the device that we're coming up with is going to do what we want it to do. Do you have any suggestions about how, from your experience and your observations, we could measure the success of this targeted approach?
My personal experience from 30 years of tax practice is that economic impact of tax incentives is far less than anyone anticipates that they're going to be. My experience is that people in business make decisions for reasons, for the most part, other than tax reasons. And unless there is a targeted financing incentive that, for example, the New Markets Tax Credit Program at the federal level, that creates opportunities to use tax benefits to do particular types of transactions that might not otherwise be done. Simply reducing rates, even in particular areas, is not an efficient way to encourage activity.
Follow up to that.
Yes.
And that's, I appreciate that answer very much. Is the, when it comes to incenting then more folks to view Oregon as an attractive location for investment, what's the proper approach? If it's not this targeted approach, which maybe all we can afford, what else is there?
I don't have a good answer to that. From talking with people who are in the business of helping startups, helping entrepreneurs, attracting businesses, the comment I have gotten time and time again is that it's not the capital gain rate, it's the rate on ordinary income that people are discouraged from coming to Oregon because of the high rates on ordinary income, much more so than on capital gains. I think that tax reform of the type that has been discussed that would impose a low-rate sales tax and a significantly reduced income tax would do far more to encourage investment in business activity in Oregon than anything that the legislature can afford if there is no sales tax.
Just a comment. This puts a bit of a damper on the balance of our conversation about capital. Can we reduce that rate?
Representative Lindsay,
Madam Chair,
did you want to comment on that?
Yes, I guess the overarching theme that I want to say is I'm happy that we're having this discussion. We're the poster child for the highest capital gains tax, at least rhetorically. Addressing this rhetorically and in a PR way, hopefully we can stop getting letters from the mayor of Chicago, from governor of Idaho, trying to poach our companies away. And I think at least rhetorically it's a very good sword to wield, and that hopefully we can start going after companies in California. We just had lunch with the governor yesterday, and we hope that he'll take up that conversation that we had, and let's start sending out letters ourselves to companies in California. Let's beat them at our rates and go get them to come here.
Thank you, Representative Lindsay. Yes, Representative Warren.
I want to thank you for reminding me why my CPA is on speed dial. Isn't the trick in a situation like this to make sure that the gaming of the system creates the economic benefit that we're looking for? So in other words, we're looking at capital gains rate reductions, or we're looking at deferments or some other solution to get the amount down, and hopefully when we do that, we find a way to incentivize reinvestment in our own state. And in my mind, that's not gaming, by the way, but some people might call it that.
Representative Wand, if I could respond, I think that it's as you pointed out at the very end of your comment, it's a question of semantics. If the impact of a complex provision like this is to cause people to do things that are desirable for the state in an effort to shoehorn themselves into the provision, more power to them. That's what we want to see. Coming up from the tax policy world at the federal level, gaming is generally used to refer to doing something that's not intended in order to take advantage. But your point is well taken.
Thank you.
Oh, you want me to be quiet?
No, I want you to ask your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I am aware that there are a lot of other proposals before us, and
but we have a real life practitioner here.
I know,
Mr. Kimmelfield. I have a question for you. As you've been described as one of the best tax attorneys on the West Coast, when you have a client that comes through and wants to sell some assets, do you strive to design the transaction in a way to target ordinary income or to target more capital gain income?
When a taxpayer is seeking to, is at the stage of exiting a business and is planning a sale, for the most part, it is There are two objectives. One is to characterize it to the greatest extent possible as capital gain income because it's taxed at a lower rate. And then second, there are, of course, efforts to defer the gain as much as possible. But the focus in the latter stage is, yes, on the capital gain income.
Follow-up question. So when you have a taxpayer that you know it traditionally is to try and achieve capital gain or deferral, so if they trigger and recognize a tax liability currently, it's going to be at the capital rate. That's the target or deferral of tax. In order to achieve the deferral, what has happened with that gain? And then what do you see your clients normally doing with the tax savings when they've achieved a capital gains tax rate? What do you see the behavior of your clients doing?
I apologize, but I'm not sure I have any answer to the question. I designed the transactions when asked, but I don't really know what their behavior is after the transaction is done.
One follow-up then. Thank you, Madam Chair. In a deferral of the gain, typically where is that gain deferred into?
There are two kinds of deferral transactions that I can think of in responding to this. One relates primarily to real estate transactions, which are probably everyone here is familiar with Section 1031 exchanges. They're essentially rolled into new real estate investments. The other types of deferral transactions are primarily in the corporate acquisition context, where an existing investment will be transferred to a corporate acquirer in exchange for stock in that company.
And an editorial comment, the reason why I asked those is because typically the money saved on a capital gain targeted, the tax savings is typically reinvested by the entrepreneur that sold the asset. In my practice, that's what I've seen. And also in those deferrals, in the deferral goal, the money continues to be reinvested back into business. Even if it is in real estate, it's still in real estate, which is housing some economic activity going on. And that's why I led you down that path, but I appreciate your playing with me. Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A moment ago, you made a comment about that. I'm not sure exactly how you said it, but the issue for discouraging people to either come here or invest in Oregon has to do with our ordinary, our high rates on ordinary income. I think that's a quote. And then you suggested that one of the possible solutions to that might have to do with a reduction in income taxes and an establishment of a sales tax. I think, that's not a quote. I think that's what you were driving at. There are, of course, other methods of getting the rates down that don't reduce income. One way would be to reduce the number of various deductions, exemptions, and credits that Oregon has. To maintain income neutrality, you could then lower the rates. Would that accomplish the same kind of goal that you're striving toward with that comment?
I'm afraid that's more of a question for an economist than for an attorney. It involves taking a detailed statistical look at types of taxpayer returns and the kinds of deductions that they report and whether those deductions are susceptible to some kind of cutback in an effort to broaden the tax base. I think broadening the tax base is a very, very difficult thing to do here. And whether it could be done sufficiently to reduce rates, I don't know. It is very difficult to do it with an outcome that involves maintaining progressivity to the same extent. And there are a lot of issues having to do that, and I can't really speak to them as an attorney.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I appreciate the answer. Let me just simply note, if I may, Madam Chair, that during the recent conversations about the tax measures that we passed in January of last year, the public discussion, at least, appears to be limited pretty much to the rate issue without recognition of the fact that Oregon has a relatively robust system that has the effect of narrowing the tax base. And it also seems to me, and of course this is probably not something you can respond to, that a big chunk of this has to do with public perception rather than any economic reality.
And you're looking at me just in case you're looking for a response.
Just in case you have one.
I would like to say, in support of what Representative Lindsay said, which was itself in response to my damper comments, that the perception in the business community is important. And although my own personal view is that reducing capital gain rates by some small amount does not have any significant impact on attracting capital, it does have an impact on the perception of the business community, and that may be important.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and thank you very much for coming. I just take the Chair's prerogative to comment. I'm very interested in the whole scope of this proposal, and I can assure you that members of this committee are not afraid of complexity, and I'm not sure that the citizens are afraid of complexity, witness our property tax system. So with that...
low blow, Madam Chair.
with that as preamble, thank you very much for coming,
thank you.
We appreciate you opening this discussion and getting it off to a very lively start.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
At this point, I am going to open.
No.
Yes. Oh, I need to close the informational hearing on capital gains, although it will continue. And open. Do I have my list? There it is. Oh, I put it on the back of here. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2412, House Bill 3050, House Bill 3187, and House Bill 3221. So that those of you who want to speak to bills globally may, and those who want to speak specifically to particular bills also may. And I'd like to first invite up Representative Cameron and Representative Parrish, and I hope someone is going to run and get Representative Wisnett and ask him to come out and speak to specific, or because they're all open, you have a sort of an open invitation to speak to the issue. Whatever order.
Chair Berger, members of the committee, for the record, State Representative Kevin Cameron, representing House District 19 here in Southeast Rural Salem, Almsville, and Turner. And it's great that I could come before you today and share a little bit about capital gains in general, since they're all open, and as well specifically about House Bill 3050. It was great to be able to sit here and listen to the dialogue in front of us, because I heard several comments about how complicated things can be, and being a hamburger flipper by trade, I kind of like to keep things simple. So I want to share a little bit about my testimony on House Bill 3050, and it is a bill that would basically cut Oregon's capital gains rate in half. And the reason for a bill like this, we heard some discussion earlier, but it would put people back to work, help investment in Oregon be created. And I'm sure you have the numbers. Although there would be a revenue hit immediately, to have $1 billion in capital gains next biennium, we obviously would have, at a 10% rate, approximately $10 billion in capital activity that transacted. And the revenue hit, if you cut the capital gains in half, the revenue hit from Paul Warner just said it would be about $400 million. But to have still $600 million in capital gains, that means we would have to have $12 billion in activity through our businesses in the next biennium. And we know over a period of time that activity would increase because of the barriers that I believe our capital gains rates set up. This sends a message, if we could do something like this too, and we heard the prior testimony about perception of business, it would send a message that Oregon is open for business and that we welcome capital here in the state of Oregon, and we welcome economic activity. Many businesses and individuals right now are saving larger amounts of cash. You can see it on corporations' books. There's cash out there that's being built up because of the uncertainty, and they are waiting for certain economic times to invest that cash, and they're going to choose long-term strategies as to where they'll go with that cash and where they'll invest it for their businesses. Businesses have options as to where they're going to locate their assets. The other thing I would like to stress is that people with high incomes are most sensitive to the capital gains tax rate. And because they possess the most flexibility as to where they will live and what they'll do with their capital, they can avoid high tax rates, high capital gains tax rates. When capital gains rates are high, people with high incomes do not sell their assets and do not realize gains. They have control over that. Or if you happen to own a lot of stock in, let's just use a shoe company, for example, and you have a $5 billion net worth and you're having a conversation with your wife over the table and say, we're going to start giving to charity, we're going to exercise $1 billion in stock options. And prior to Measure 66 and 67, I would have written a check to the state of Oregon for $90 million when I exercised those options. Since Measure 66 and 67, I would now write a check to the state of Oregon for $110 million if I had that kind of money. For $20 million, I'm going to look at my wife and I'm going to say, hey, we can go get a condominium across the river for 6 months. And then exercise our $1 billion in stock options. Where's the $110 million going to go? Where'd the $90 million go? Not to the state of Oregon. It stayed in that individual's pocket. Let me give you another example. Let's talk about two businesses, or one business that was sold 14 miles north of the Washington border this last year. Small business, $150,000 in capital gains. One partner who happened to live in the area that sold their share of that business paid zero on their $150,000 in capital gains. The other partner who happened to live in Salem, Oregon, is going to pay 9 or 10 or 11% in capital gains on that. That small person for the $10,000 is not going to pick up and move to save $10,000. But let's go back to the wealthy person. They will, and they'll move their capital out of our state. So I would suggest to you that this would help keep capital in our state that's here today, and that it will attract new capital that's being accumulated ready for investment in the future. I know the revenue numbers are large when you look at them in the biennium, but I'd also suggest to you that you could avoid all that by stretching this out over a period of time, and those are options that are before you. But I want to encourage us to make our capital gains rate attractive and competitive to those states and those businesses that are surrounding us, and I thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Cameron?
Thank you, Representative Berger. Members of the committee, I'm Julie Parrish. I represent House District 37, which is Tualatin and West Lynn. I'm here to talk about 3221 because while we heard from lawyers and accountants, as a humble business owner who does not own millions of shares of shoe company, 3221, albeit it probably has some technical challenges with it, I think fundamentally addresses what the small business owners in our state look at when they think about capital gains. So Oregon is about 85-90%, give or take a few percent, small business. And if you think about where a small business owner has typically bootstrapped their business, they've tapped the capital in their home. Now, what is happening to the capital in our homes right now? I can tell you right now, my house has lost significant equity. And if I wanted to go and tap my home for capital gain or for capital expenditure in my business, I can't do it right now. I also can't leverage my home at the bank to go and tap capital a different way. So when a bank looks at a small business in Oregon, right now when housing prices are underwater and housing prices are going to continue to fall for the next, feasibly, next few years. Small business owners who need access to capital don't have it. So what's that doing to small business owners who currently have a going concern? Well, it means that they are looking to possibly move across the border. It means that they are in the process of shutting down. And all of those one and two and five people companies now are suddenly at risk. And so it becomes this incremental loss of jobs in our state. So while this might not be technically the most proficient bill in terms of execution, it has elements in here that I think are really important. And as you do consider all capital gains bills, that you consider them with a small business bent as well. 3221 specifically says that if I realize my a capital gain, and like Representative Cameron said, I don't have to realize this gain in Oregon. And I'm in a very unique position that my business partner lives in Wyoming. And they have zero corporate tax, and they have zero income tax. And they have a marginal sales tax, and they have policy that says that we leverage our natural resources. And she owns 50% of the company. And as our CEO, I have a fiduciary responsibility to our company to make sure that I do the best thing by our company. And yet every year at tax time when we have this conversation, I tell her I want to still be an Oregon business. So we're going to stay here. And I'm going to try to find ways to, you know, continue to grow our business in Oregon, even though she's got a better opportunity with our company in Wyoming. For 5 years, we've continued at tax time to say we're going to be an Oregon company, because eventually she'd like to live here. This bill says that if I have a capital gain, if I realize my gain in Oregon, that I could use it to expand my business, that I could use it to create a new entity, that I could use it to invest in somebody else's entity, that I could use it for operating capital. And right now, it's about cash flow. Keeping people's businesses alive is about cash flow. I need Post-it notes, and I need the server folks in Beaverton who I've hired to manage my servers, and I need the folks in Portland who I've managed to do my newsletters. Those people are employing people on my behalf, and I need operating capital. So our small businesses need operating capital to make those businesses keep going. This bill also says then that I've got a time to pay it back. I've got a time to defer it, and then I have a time that I need to pay it back. But I can continue to roll my deferral and treat this like going from a condo to a McMansion, kind of like a home equity, because I've had four businesses in Oregon, and I don't ever want to be in a position where I have to bootstrap every business from the ground up. The next time I do something with my company, if I want to sell it, if I want to grow it, if I want to start a new one, I don't want to start back here in a manufactured home and go out and try to look for capital. I want to be able to start as a mid-tier suburbs homeowner and grow from there. And that's what capital gains, I think, for small businesses looks like on boots on the ground, is how do I take what I have and leverage it and make it grow into something so I can continue to hire contractors and developers and people who are also business owners in Oregon. Because, like I said, we'd like to be an Oregon company. We'd like to continue to grow our company here. But every time tax time rolls around, and this is for not just for my company, it's for all small businesses, we look at the tax liability and what it means to actually have our business operate here in Oregon and go, is this worth the money? Because if it's cheaper for me to operate it in Wyoming and I can hire more Oregonians, then that's just a crime. That I should have to move my business to another state so I can hire more Oregonians, it is just unfathomable to me. So I continue to, it's April 15th, right around the corner. We're going to continue to keep being an Oregon company. But something's got to change in Oregon, and it's got to change for these small businesses. And if we want our backbone of our state to come in and invest and take those risks, I think we have to find a way in this body to take those risks with our small business owners and to hold their hand and say, you know what, we're willing to back you and take the risk. And if we don't do that, we're going to continue to see small business in this state erode. So, you know, I'd like to see more companies that have billions of dollars of shoes come to Oregon, but we're small business folks. And so anything you do around capital gains, and this might not be the vehicle, but there are elements to make this the vehicle, including looking at this going back to January 1st of this year, because there are people out there realizing those gains right now to try to save their businesses. We got to give those folks some relief. So any elements out of this you can take and add to something to make a really nice package, I'm all on board with that. Thank you.
Representative Brewer, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing I wanted to point out about Representative Parrish's bill, and consistent with your reputation that you've quickly developed, you are an outside-the-box thinker. This bill actually is a hybrid, looking at the technical language. It's a hybrid of both a deferral of the gain recognition, but also a deferral of the payment of taxes. And we've not had that proposed. And so this is a hybrid and probably something worthy of discussion, because that what you're bringing up really gets to the heart of small business. And so I'm not saying that that I agree or disagree with the elements of the bill, and it is technically problematic, but it is an interesting concept. And I just want to put that out there.
Thank you. Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you. Was this intended to apply to Oregon businesses or businesses anywhere?
No, this actually specifically says that you will create, that you will do this in Oregon. This is going to be, I will invest in your business in Oregon, my business in Oregon. This also lets me apply my gain to a vehicle like the Oregon Entrepreneur Network. Mm-hmm. Now I can invest through another entity and let other businesses thrive if I'm in that point and stage in my business where I want to give that back, because I'm a huge believer in mentorship and helping other people up along the lines. That this would say, well, I could take my gain and put it into a vehicle that other people are going to use to grow business in Oregon.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions? Representative Wisner, I know you have to get to your own committee. You're in the chair, so please.
Thank you, Chair Berger, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. I'm testifying on my bill, House Bill 3187, a bill to help grow Oregon's economy and create desperately needed jobs in the state. My bill's simple. It creates a subtraction from net capital gains for the purpose of personal income and corporate income and excise taxation starting in the years 2012 through 2016 tax year. You've heard a lot of good testimony today, and I think it's really great that this committee is looking at capital gain reduction and trying to come up with something that's acceptable to everyone. As you've been told, state economists tell us it takes as many as 4 years for Oregon to reach its pre-recession employment levels. House Bill 3187 creates a four-year window to promote economic activity and increase investment in our state. House Bill 3187 is a smart investment in job creation. The National Bureau of Economic Research found that 50% of a cut in capital gains is recovered by a higher economic growth. When the federal government cut capital gains in 1980, 1997, and 2003, they received more revenue each year than the following years. That's a fact. Madam Chair and committee members, this is a simple one. It just says, look, you know, get rid of it for 5 years. I think the governor proposed like 50% reduction during that same time or something like that. I've heard people advise me, says, Gene, your bill, maybe you should look at saying our capital gains in Oregon is going to be 1% less than California and Washington to make us bring in more industry that we've talked about. You have a big challenge ahead of you. I hope that you'll make the right selection for businesses and the citizens of Oregon. If my bill helps you, I would be glad to work with amendments or however you want to do that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Did you have a question, Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Representative Parrish, have you had a chance to look at the capital gains deferral program that was passed by the 95 legislative session?
I have not, no.
Hello, Madam Chair.
Yes.
If I might make a comment.
By all means.
Thank you. I appreciate the creative thinking that's gone into all of the work around capital gains, and certainly the issue of access to capital has been an issue that has been on the minds of this legislative body, and how do we get capital in the hands of small businesses. I think we made some good steps last session with our Boost program, with the severance pay program that we referenced earlier in this committee. We had a similar program in 95 you might take a look at that had some unintended consequences for businesses and was not particularly successful. And so I might be in favor of looking at how can we learn from some of the lessons of that program. I think also, Madam Co-Chair, as we look at the larger issue of capital gains and how do we stimulate the economy by sending signals to businesses, I think it's worth being aware of the trade-offs that are inherent in the discussion. Certainly, the tax rate and the tax structure has a role in how we attract and grow businesses in this state. But it's also not the entire story, right? You have access to a trained and qualified workforce. You have a robust education system, and not only that is going to grow the talent for these jobs, but also that businesses are going to want to attract workers to be able to put their kids in that education system. You have a good infrastructure program. You have single sales factor. You have all these different things that are part of creating a good business climate in Oregon. So I would hope that as we have this discussion around capital gains, we can have a very cogent discussion of the trade-offs between how we balance what's good for business on one hand and what's good for business on the other, so we can have a really robust discussion about economic development in this state. Thanks for starting the discussion.
Thank you. And I would just say then you'll probably like the education bills that I've got dropped on Friday for next week that address just that.
I'd like to invite Representative Reed to come down and invite you guys to stay as long as, you know, to continue this discussion.
Madam Chair, if I may, why Representative Wisnett suggested that we have a 1% capital gains rate lower than Washington. I would like to be getting a refund when I exercise a capital gain. They have none, so a minus one capital gain rate would be really nice.
I get that, yes. You are welcome to stay and continue.
Thank you for your time.
I don't, yes, I appreciate you coming.
Did you have a question?
No, it was simply a comment about the comment. He's right, of course.
Representative Reed, you also have 2412.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27. Nice to see you all from a different angle this morning. I would just add a couple of comments and an additional approach for the consideration and perhaps a preview of another one that's coming. A lot of what I was going to say was covered by Representative Bailey, but I would like to echo some comments that Mr. Kimmelfield made about taxes being but one factor that play into decisions that businesses and individual people make. And that, in fact, for me, cuts both ways. It's one factor, so there are lots of others, but this is an important one and in some cases a first one. So the bill that we've introduced and is before you for consideration as part of what I think is a much broader discussion moves the rate to 9% where it has been before. And so that's the first component I'd like to address. I am not someone who will sit before you and suggest that reducing the capital gains will increase revenue. It might happen, but it might not. What I will say is, with some confidence, is that having a rate that puts us near the top or at the top of the list makes it more difficult for us as a state to get to the rest of the discussion about the other great things that are in Oregon, many of which Representative Bailey eloquently listed. So that's part of what my motivation is in this approach. The other thing that's interesting about capital gains, all of us in revenue, of course, get a lot of numbers, but one that has stuck with me ever since I first heard it was the standard deviation on the forecasts for income. The personal income, as you recall, was about 5.6% standard deviation. The corporate income was 34%. And I remember those of you that were here, I think it was 2007, the economist, state economist who had been in several different states saying that they had a little club and that if you got closer than 34%, they knew you were cheating. 34%. I asked Paul this morning, and he didn't have the specific number, but it's safe to say that the volatility on the capital gains rates is even higher than that, which is a problem. All of us, I think, can agree that the volatility of our revenue structure is a big problem. So that's the second half of the bill that's before you. I recognize that it would have some big trade-offs to make, but the bill as written directs the collections from capital gains to the rainy day fund to stimulate that conversation about the stability and relative volatility of capital gains. I would pick up two other quick comments to say a little more about Representative Bailey's comment about rollover versus deferral, because I know we have some other rollover approaches, and that's an important distinction. The experience from the 95 turned out, though I think it was written as a rollover, to be a deferral, and that's an important distinction. The community that used that approach is relatively small, and the effect that it had was significantly dampened when the effect was a deferral as opposed to a rollover, so that someone who had started at a base, had a gain, reinvested, and then subsequently lost to below the original basis was then assessed the tax based on the gain that they had thereafter lost. And I realize I'm not sure if I'm saying that very clearly, but it turned out to be a deferral as opposed to a rollover. So if we go the rollover approach, which I think has some significant merit, let's be very sure that we do that in a way that has that effect, because I think that might actually work as opposed to the deferral. The last is to preview a bill that I hope comes to this committee as well. I just received some amendments from Legislative Council that has it doing something much closer to what I intended in the original draft, which is essentially an incentive to invest now. There's a statutory definition for emerging growth business, and the approach that we're thinking about in this next in this other bill would say if you invest in an emerging growth business in Oregon over the next period of time, a limited time offer, then capital gains that you enjoy at a subsequent time would be at a discounted rate. So it's essentially an act now sort of offer. And in the constrained budget environment in which we operate, I think is likely to have a lower price tag. So with that, perhaps sort of a survey, I'd be happy to respond to any questions that you might have, though I might do it from up there, too.
Question for Representative. Thank you. Thank you very much. This has been a good discussion. At this point, all of the bills are open, and I have a list. I'm going to take you up in panels, if you wouldn't mind, and hear from the folks who have signed up first and then invite anyone else. And I'm going to start with Jan Meekum, Bob Wiggins, and Roger Byer. Please, if you would. Oops. Yeah, they pulled me. We appreciate you coming. Please proceed.
I appreciate being here. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Berger, and Co-Chair, Representative Barnhart, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums. I'm the State Director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. I represent our 7,000 small business members in the state of Oregon. I wish to address one particular element of capital gains tax issue as it affects our small business members. According to the SBA, Oregon has over 300,000 small business members in our state. And about one in 10 adult Americans, ages 18 to 64, are currently taking active steps to create a business. Virtually all are doing so because they want to, not because they have to. They are America's entrepreneurs. They are the economic engine of this country. They are innovators, risk takers, and job providers. For most, they do not invest in the stock market. Too many do not have pension plans, 401ks, or even IRAs. What they do have is their business. That is their primary investment portfolio. They are not gaming the tax code. They invest back in their business to maintain it, to grow it, to provide jobs. What is the carrot that drives them to take these risks, work hard, and reinvest in their enterprise? It is the hope and the dream that they can provide for themselves, their families, their employees along the way to a secure future upon retirement. That when the time comes, 20 or 30 years down the road, they will have a valuable asset to sell that will provide for a comfortable, financially stable end game. After paying taxes at all levels throughout one's business life, than to be faced with high capital gains tax because of doing business and providing jobs in Oregon is punitive. As you are well aware, Oregon has the highest personal and corporate rates in the country, and also one of the highest, if not the highest, capital gains tax. A triple tax whammy is what we have here in Oregon. We believe Oregon's capital gains tax needs a significant reduction. A reduced capital gains tax will add enticement and incentive to doing business in Oregon and support those that are already here contributing to our economy. It is important that capital gains treatment is simple. One thing small business does not need is another complex tax code to try and follow and implement. A simple rate reduction. Reinvestment, and I would like to change my written testimony, I said does not work to may not work when one is retiring and may choose to move out of state for personal reasons, such as health or familial. Keeping a business in operation in the form of selling it does maintain economic benefit to Oregon. A simple reduced rate is what we are advocating on behalf of our members. I thank you for your time this morning and am welcome to accept any questions.
Thank you. I think I'll complete the panel and then we'll invite questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing Oregon Small Woodlands Association. Oregon Small Woodlands Association has about 1,500 members statewide who own between 1 and 5,000 acres of timberland. I'd like to point out, first and foremost, that eliminating or reducing capital gains is one of the basic premises that a Small Woodland Association believes in and one of their principal founding positions. With our members, it is literally you are harvesting what your ancestors may have acquired, and when you replant, you're replanting for your descendants. And I would argue with only briefly with what Representative Cameron said about it's easy to move a business out of state. It is very difficult to move a tree farm out of state. That is, we are kind of stuck here, you might say. So with the basic premise of our position is to eliminate or greatly reduce the capital gains tax in Oregon, we would also like to see it done simply for all the reasons that have already been expressed. We don't need a more complex tax code. I know that Representative Ira Brewer would probably like that and a member of the CPA world, but for those of us owning businesses, we would prefer a simple tax code. Having said that, of the four bills in front of you today, House Bill 3187 would be our personal choice. That is simple, easy, and it takes the capital gains rate to zero. We think that's where it needs to be on our crop. If that is not possible, we would prefer House Bill 3050 be the next choice. Again, House Bill 3050 offers some tax relief to all capital gain people, not just individuals. We think that's important. The corporate people should be considered also. We do like the concept in House Bill 2412. We do not believe capital gains tax should be used for the general fund and for daily obligations. We believe that it is a one-time occurrence and it is too volatile to fund general operations. Representative Reed, we very much agree with that concept. And if you are going to only reduce capital gains, we prefer you take any gain and put it into a rainy day fund or something like that. We think that's an appropriate use for money. Just like we can't harvest the same log every year, we do it once in a lifetime. We believe the tax on that should be put away for special circumstances. And finally, as drafted, House Bill 3221 does not fit into our principles of support. The bill defers payment of the tax only after it's been invested and saved and held for 5 years. And what's going to happen in that case is many taxpayers are going to find the tax bill come due 5 years later, and they're going to have no money to pay the bill. And I recognize it does defer then the payment for another time, but we don't believe that fits the principle of reducing or eliminating capital gains. That just puts it off to another day. If the bill was changed so that after 5 years of investment, if the investment is a qualified investment, the tax is then forgiven or eliminated, we would support that concept, but you had to prove up for 5 years first. That would fit our principle, and we would support that.
With that information, I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Good morning. My name is Bob Wiggins. I'm the manager of Mount Hood Equity Partners, which is a venture capital fund headquartered in Lake Oswego. Off-topic, but not off-topic, early in my career, I was a tax lawyer at Stoll Reeves. I do not consider myself a nerd. I think at the end here. For us. Mount Hood Equity Partners is a venture capital fund. All of our investors are wealthy individuals, many of whom are or were Oregon residents. None of our funding is from the Oregon Growth Account or the Oregon Investment Fund. Mount Hood Equity Partners invests in early-stage technology companies located in the Pacific Northwest. In most cases, these companies also have raised equity investment from what are called angel investors. Over the past 15 years, I've also made angel investments as an individual in a number of other Oregon-based startups. I'm here today to encourage the legislature to modify the Oregon income tax by reducing the tax rate applicable to long-term capital gains. One important effect of this change will be to stem the tide of wealthy Oregonians who are leaving the state when they're about to sell their businesses. This matters for many reasons, not the least of which is that when an Oregonian moves from the state, Oregon collects its 11% capital gain tax on $0, since these people are no longer Oregon residents. I want to focus on a different issue, though, the impact of Oregon's highest in the country capital gain rate on angel investment in Oregon. Angel investment is a critical part of the growth path of many companies that ultimately become significant employers. Angel investors are wealthy individuals, many of whom become wealthy by building and then selling their businesses. These investors then reinvest some of the proceeds of the sale of their businesses in new businesses. Sometimes the angel runs the new business, sometimes they serve as a director or advisor, and sometimes they're just passive investors. Companies that I've invested in over the last 15 years, either as an individual angel or through Mount Hood Equity Partners, include Routeware, which is a very fast-growing Beaverton company in the waste management technology space that currently employs 20 people. I believe that's in Representative Reed's district. Site 9, which is a rapidly growing Portland software company with customers all over the world that currently employs 10 people. Learning.com, which is a Portland company that was a pioneer in online delivery of educational software, which currently employs 90 people. Varis Industries, a Tigard company in the automation system peripherals business, which currently employs over 100 people. BLT Technologies, a telecommunications company that was headquartered in Vancouver and at its height employed 160 people. Legal Anywhere, a Tualatin-based legal software company that employed 25 people, and many other companies. There are hundreds of angel-funded businesses in Oregon which employ thousands of people. They were started with equity financing provided by local angel investors and have not depended on any investment at all from the taxpayers. Not all companies start with angel investment. Many small businesses are started with the labor and funds of the founders and their families. What sets angel-funded companies apart is that they need larger amounts of early equity, in part because their growth plans are more ambitious. And not every high-growth company starts with angel money either. Some businesses receive early funding from large industry players, government grants, or venture capital firms. But for many high-growth businesses, without angel funding, they would never have gotten off the ground. And remember, in many cases, the angel just doesn't provide money. They also provide advice and support that is critical to new entrepreneurs. To build fast-growing businesses that employ lots of Oregonians, angel investment is an essential part of the mix. Oregon should want to have as many angels as we can live here. Unfortunately, our tax policy and the proximity of income tax-free Washington and the 48 other states that tax capital gains at a lower rate than Oregon serve as a strong incentive to individuals who are about to have a large capital gain on a sale of their business to establish residency in another state, avoiding Oregon's highest in the nation capital gains tax. Does this really happen? Of course it does. I know business people who have moved out of the state to avoid taxes. I'll leave it to others to testify as to empirical evidence, but I will note that of the investors in Mount Hood Equity Partners who were Oregon residents 10 years ago, over 20% of them no longer are. And the pace of that change accelerated last year. It is true that some Oregonians who leave remain engaged in Oregon's business and charitable world. Many do not. And none of them who leave ever pay any further Oregon income taxes. I know many people do not think it is fair that capital gains are taxed federally at a lower rate than ordinary income, and therefore are very happy with the current Oregon situation. Here's why a lower capital gain rate is, in fact, fair. If you go to work as an employee, you have a legal right to your wages. Your employer has to pay you what you earned. You don't have to make an investment in the employer to get your job. You can, of course, lose your job, as thousands of Oregonians have, but whatever wages you have earned are yours. Wages are taxed at ordinary income rates. If you make an equity investment, whether in a business or real estate or some other asset, you may someday sell the investment at a profit. You also could completely lose the amount of your investment. The entire amount invested is at risk. Risk capital is essential to economic growth, and the federal tax code has at least tried to encourage risk capital. That is at least part of the reason why the U.S. Congress has always taxed capital gains at a lower rate than ordinary income. I do not think it is necessary or fair for Oregon to eliminate capital gain taxation completely. I apologize to my friend to the right here. I am convinced, however, that if Oregon reduced its capital gain rate to a level closer to other states, that we would lose fewer potential angel investors. If we want a thriving, growing economy, the state needs business people who are willing to put some of the profits from the sale of their businesses back to work in Oregon, and we need to keep as many of those people in Oregon as we possibly can. And I also would be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you for coming, Mr. Wigan. Questions? Yes, Representative Warren.
Just a quick one. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. In your experience, do angel investors tend to invest in companies that are nearby to where they live?
Yeah, that's that. I mean, not always, but certainly the ability to keep an eye on what's going on is important.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? I thank you all for coming. Mr. Wiggins, your company is specific to Northwest.
Our investment philosophy is to invest basically within driving distance of Lake Oswego because I don't like to fly.
And how long have you been in this?
Mount Hood Equity Partners, the fund, was founded in 2005. I've been angel investing for 15 years.
And if I understand you correctly, you believe that there has been a shift of this kind of investment or the investors who will be investing away from the state of Oregon because of tax policy?
I believe that individuals who have been angel investors have moved out of the state in part because of tax policy. That doesn't mean that, you know, it doesn't happen anymore. Obviously, it happens. I'm doing it, and I still live here. But there are people who were active angel investors who sold their businesses and have moved out of the area, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wigan. Yes.
Thank you. I guess this question is for Mr. Beyer. The written testimony indicates reducing the tax on this type of income which helps for more investment long-term enterprises like timber. But, of course, long-term suggests years down the road. How would someone planting trees today be assured that whoever takes our place doesn't come in and raise the taxes? Is it your thought that this whole exercise is an effort to show that Oregon is enthusiastic in the long term for this type of investment, and we're merely hoping people will believe us? What is it that we do today that would suggest that we'll do something like it 10 years or 20 years from now?
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, obviously I know as well as you know that no legislature can bind a future legislature to anything. So there is no guarantees, and I don't know who the famous person who said, you know, the quote about life, liberty, and property is not safe while the legislature is in session. But I believe, I mean, 19th century. You know, past history is a good indicator of future performance, and Oregon has traditionally maintained this high capital gain rate, and I believe that if it was lowered or reduced or limited at this point in time, I think that would send a great message to investors that Oregon has changed its philosophy, and it's now going to be better for a business climate for long-term investors in natural resources, at least timber. And would send a great signal.
Follow up.
Yes.
I suppose we have to start somewhere and some time, but it would take more than just a single legislative session to send that signal, don't you think?
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Vance. Absolutely, but I think, and I think a danger of a sunsetted capital gains rate would not spur investment, and that is the one problem I see with 3187, is that it is actually a sunsetted. The way I read it, it happens for 4 years, and then it goes back to where it is today. I don't believe that would be the best approach. I believe you need to set a rate and keep maintain that rate, or go the opposite way, start ratcheting a rate down to a, you know, final ending place. Our preference would be zero, but at any rate, you know, if you need to stair step it, make sure it's stair stepping in a downward direction, not going down and then coming back up at some point in the future. That would be do the opposite. That would force people to, much like the federal inheritance tax did, at, you know, everybody wanted to die in 2010 because that's when, if you're planning your death, that's when you wanted to do it. An increasing capital gains rate would do the same thing. People who have those investments, especially timber, and who have the ability to harvest at a certain time, would accelerate the harvest to that day and create a windfall for the tax code for that 1 year, and then a crash in the following years.
Thank you.
Further questions for this panel? Thank you very, very much for coming.
You.
We appreciate your time and your thoughts on this subject. I'm going to call another panel of Jody Weiser and John Mullen. I'm trying to kind of keep...
Yes and no, huh?
Yeah, let's keep them.
Yesterday we couldn't do that because there was much harder to fight the people on both sides.
I'm just trying to... Thank you.
For the record, my name is Jody Weiser. So I tried reading this morning. It took me 5 minutes to read the part in italics, so I'm not going to read it at all. I'll just highlight some things. You know, often when we talk about capital gains, we talk about Washington and the difference between the two states. And obviously, there are big differences between. Washington is far wealthier than Oregon. They have more large businesses. They have higher per capita income, and they have more personal wealth. But most of that, it seems to us, is about happenstance. It's not about anything legislators can affect. We couldn't affect whether Bill Gates or Phil Knight lived in our state. They lived where they lived, and that's why the businesses are where their businesses are. Same thing would be true for Bill Boeing and for the Boyles. They were in those places with their businesses, and they changed. Mr. Boeing had a forestry industry, and he got interested in airplanes, and now there is Boeing. It's in Washington State. It's not here. Likewise, if you look at the business leaders across our state that have been here for a long time, nobody lured most of them here. They were here. This is where they started their business, and this is where their business is today. We have gotten businesses to come here, and we often talk about the tax system and the benefits that we offer when we talk about that, but we rarely talk about the fact that we have low power rates and we have cheap and clean and ample water. And those two items are things that the legislatures of other states can't change. They can't get lower power rates and they can't get, you know, water like we have. So these are all kind of happenstance things. Federal dollars are way higher in Washington State than they are here. But the decisions about where bases we're going to locate were made long ago. You can influence that. And the millions and millions of dollars that are spent on cleaning up Hanford are probably not dollars that we wish we had in Oregon. But Washington has three times more large public companies than we have, but we have eight times more small private companies than they have. Likewise, you can't choose that. It is, in fact, the success of some of our businesses is why the company headquarters have left. And finally, a huge piece in terms of the wealth differences between the two states and the number of, you know, the percentage of wealthy people in each state has to do with the generosity of the people who founded companies in each place. You hear many times of Microsoft millionaires, and there are people who never rose above being a secretary at Microsoft who are millionaires now. Happened that Bill Gates passed out stock to everybody at first. Didn't happen in any of the companies in Oregon, and so we don't have that kind of distribution of wealth. And finally, long ago, the tax systems were put in place in each state. And the people of Washington are no more willing to have an income tax than the people of Oregon are willing to have a sales tax. And so in each case, the legislature's hands are pretty well tied in terms of what you can do about addressing how you raise revenue. In each state, they're stuck with pretty much the system they have, the primary tax. The revenue source is set in place, and it's not something that the legislature is going to change. Some consequences of that are the wealthy in Washington State pay about 5% less in state and local taxes than the wealthy in Oregon. And the 80% of the population at the bottom in Oregon pay about 5% less than those in Washington State. So our tax system is more flat. And theirs is rapidly, the bottom 20% of Washingtonians pay twice as much in tax as Oregonians in that same 20% of the population. That's probably part of why we have a lower per capita income. The pay that jobs give, whether they're lawyers or tree planters, are based on the cost of living. And part of our cost of living is lower taxes for 80% of the population than in our neighboring state. So does changing the capital gains tax actually going to affect anything significant? Is it going to change the number of big companies we have? Is it going to change the per capita income in our state? Is it going to raise wages? It's probably not going to encourage a lot more people to come here and start businesses if we cut our capital gains rate any more than if we cut our capital gains rate, we could get our companies to go out and start paying 10% higher wages, which would bring our per capita income up, or we could get 9% of the people to move away because we changed it. There's just not going to be an easy relationship between shifting that one piece of our tax structure and thinking we're going to get a return that's going to change the environment in our state significantly. So looking at the bills, there are elements of 2412 that we really like. It's a concept that we've discussed at our group a number of times. Here's our volatile piece of income. Here's the place where we need to save it. We've talked more about putting half the money into a rainy day fund rather than 100% of it in. But we also think that you would need to raise the cap on the rainy day fund from 7.5% to probably at least 12.5% or 15% to do what we wanted to do. But if 2412 had been in place in 2003 when we started coming out of the last recession, we would have had about six times as much money in rainy day funds as we have when we faced this one. And that would have felt really different, and it would have taken some of the roller coaster out of our tax system, and certainly is something that we need to address, is that roller coaster. We have some written comments about 3221, but I think those have been kind of addressed in by the carrier of the bill herself, that you can't have a bill that is dependent upon words like capital assets or business entity without having definitions of those words. Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen here as the co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon Tax and Revenue Committee. I want to start out by saying some of the best and most important discussion this session has been going on in this committee. I really appreciate it. And if there was an easy path to look at tax changes, we would have gotten there many, many years ago. I go back to the 1980s with discussion about the tax system here in the state of Oregon. As you know, the Human Services Coalition adopted tax and revenue principles going way back. And our initial ones about fairness, adequacy, and stability are all in play when we think about capital gains. In the short term, we're concerned about the adequacy of the budget. This is something that is a pressing issue for us, and undoubtedly I'll be before you other times during this session to talk about that. We're concerned about getting an adequate budget adopted. So changes in capital gains in the short term are really concerning as far as the adequacy aspect of it. But nevertheless, in my testimony, I talked about the fact that we are intrigued by House Bill 2412. We have testified previously about about our interest in seeing funds put into the Oregon Rainy Day Fund. And we talked about that in reference to the kicker in the past. So we would, we're certainly open to have more discussion about the concepts in 2412. We think that they make sense. We really recognize, particularly for human services where we know we run counter-cyclical to the economy, that it's really in the best interest to have savings put aside for times when times are bad in the state of Oregon. So, as always, appreciate the opportunity to testify and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mullen. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate hearing from you. And the last panel is J.L. Wilson, Jeremy Rogers, and Dave Reinhart.
Thank you. Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industries. The trick here, of course, is to say something that hasn't been said so far, so I'll try to make this interesting. You know, absent wholesale tax reform, which we believe with the first speaker is probably the best thing that could happen to incent economic growth in the state. We believe absent that, the best thing that the legislature could do is lower the capital gains rate, not only for the message that it sends that Oregon is open for business, but also with the realization that we are competing for capital in a marketplace that is so intensely competitive right now. And there is no good that comes from an uncompetitive capital gains tax rate right now. You preclude yourself the type of investments that you want in your economy that spurs economic growth, and even you as policymakers preclude yourself from so many taxable events that would generate revenue and fund the public services to the extent that we want by virtue of a capital gains rate that is uncompetitive. I just wanted to, this gives me some opportunity to talk about job creation and how we see it at Associated Oregon Industries. One of the common things that we see, and I should backtrack by saying, you should have some understanding that the correlation between jobs in business growth, business size, and that is most jobs generated today are from new companies. And that is companies that are newly established and start the growth curve, that is where your job growth is going to occur. And so the question is, how do you incent that? How do you make it so that Oregon is a place that people want to sell their assets, accumulate capital, create a demand for labor, which pushes up wages, and then be in a position to perhaps sell those assets again? You know, can you do that with a 10% capital gains tax rate? Just some examples of what we see at AOI. We, you know, a manager with Willamette Industries who sold his assets, liquidated his stock in the company, starts a plastic, somebody who fabricates recycled plastics, a company in Malala, has 50 employees now and was able to do that through realization of capital gains initially, starts a company, accumulates his own assets, hires people. 50 jobs in Malala is a pretty big deal, which pushes up the demand for wages. I mean, that's how this is supposed to work. On the flip side, when I had the privilege of representing NFIB, I had an NFIB Oregon member who then became an NFIB Washington member, but he was a manager at Tyco here in Dallas, did the exact same thing, but realized on the sale of his first company that it made no sense to do this in Oregon, and as he relayed to me, the sales on his capital gains alone bought him his first home in Vancouver, and so now he buys companies, builds them up, and sells them in Vancouver. And that is the type of thing we preclude ourselves from with a rate that this high. And so I think as policymakers, you have to ask yourself, you know, why would you not want to give yourself all the opportunities available to create these types of taxable events in state? And I guess the subsequent question is, do you really think that you can do that with a close to 11% marginal rate, especially when you consider what other states are doing. Of course, we've heard Washington at zero, but what about Nevada? Nevada's zero. Idaho's at 7.8. Arizona's at 4.5. Utah and Montana at 5%. New Mexico has an effective rate of about 2.65. I mean, rates that are just far, far more competitive. You know, as it was mentioned by Ms. Weiser before, Oregon is not a wealth magnet. But are we going to throw up our hands and just do nothing about it? You got to compete to become a wealth magnet. And one of the things I loved about the governor's budget is this implicit recognition that which he does with a film tax credit. You know, New Mexico is going to scrap theirs. So you know what? We're going to make our state even more attractive for this type of activity. So why wouldn't this apply for something like general investment and capital gains? It applies perfectly. And so why wouldn't we do this in our state to attract the type of investment that we want so that we're competitive in this environment for investment and job creation? So we would support concepts that lower the rate, either by lowering the rate or offering exclusions. That would be our preference. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Berger, Co-Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today, and also want to comment on the work of this committee. I think it's fundamental to Oregon's ability, both for job creation and for the ability to fund public services. And my name is Jeremy Rogers, and I'm the project director for the Oregon Business Council. OBC is an association of roughly 45 CEOs from companies either based in or with significant operations in Oregon. Since 1985, OBC has played a central role in addressing public issues important to Oregonians through research, analysis, internal discussions, and collaboration with other organizations and public officials. I'm also the project manager for the Oregon Business Plan, which is a collaborative effort among the state's largest business associations, along with representatives from key boards, commissions, chambers of commerce, regional economic development organizations. And the goal of the plan is to identify, advocate, and track progress on initiatives that will help Oregon create 25,000 new jobs per year and get its per capita income above the national average by 2020. And we're pleased to note that the governor has adopted those goals and included many elements of the plan in his proposals, as well as many elements of the plan are moving forward in the legislature. Just wanted to thank you for your work on job creation. Today's topic of tax policy, it's one of the key initiatives that we've identified in the business plan. And we've also done a lot of research at OBC on, so I felt it was something I should testify on. We believe, and at OBC through our research, but also conversations with business leaders and economic development leaders around the state, that Oregon's current tax policy is slowing job creation and income growth. The current policy provides almost no stability, and while our overall tax burden is actually slightly below the national average, the tax on income and capital gains is the highest in the nation. This type of tax policy discourages investment, wealth, and the very type of high-wage activity that we aspire to, yet it still leaves Oregon struggling, unstable, and unable to fund basic services during good and bad times. So, and that's just on the tax side. Oregon is in the same boat with many states in terms of dealing with issues of the cost of providing public services and their growth due to a multitude of factors, including rising health care costs, unfunctioned pension liabilities, ballot measures, and other things, and it's outstripping our ability to pay for them. These are all serious challenges. They're all connected, and we appreciate the you know, serious eye that this committee and the legislature is putting to all of them this legislative session. The issue before us today, don't think I can overstate what I believe are the negative consequences of Oregon's nation-leading income and capital gains taxes. You know, generally speaking, high capital gains tax rates, substantially increase the difference between what an investment yields and what an individual investor actually receives, known as a tax wedge. The higher the tax wedge, the fewer the number of investments will meet the hurdle rate or the minimal acceptable rate of return for an investor, resulting in fewer investments being undertaken. However, I think the biggest problem for Oregon is not simply just that we have an incentive against investment. The Portland metro region is the only metropolitan region in the United States where within the same metro area, an individual or household can gain all the same quality of life, amenities, and advantages, while at the same time choosing between 9 and 11% and 0% rate for income and capital gains taxes. Economists like to use the term all else being equal. Usually it doesn't mean much. In this case, I think maybe one of the only cases where it's actually very, very relevant. All else being equal, Vancouver, Washington is no further away from downtown Portland than Lake Oswego, You can be in this metro area and live in Washington and make that choice. So concerned about this, we worked with Echo Northwest in 2009 to determine if there is a significant migration of wealth, at least north of the border to Clark County. The results were clear, and they match up with some national work that's been done on this topic as well, and which I have a copy of that study, but I didn't have copies for the committee. Echo Northwest used IRS data on filers that move from one county to another between tax years, and they use this data to determine if incomes of taxpayers that move to Clark County from the three principal Portland, Oregon counties, Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington, were substantially different than those that moved in the other direction. The analysis limited the scope to Clark and the three Portland counties to avoid any biases that would come from comparing places with substantially different socioeconomic characteristics. All four counties share a common labor market. They're all within commuting distance of one another, and none has large retirement communities. I've submitted the full study of the Echo Northwest for the record, and there's a table included in the next page of my testimony that I think you'd be interested in looking at. The study revealed that the average AGI of those moving, adjusted gross income, of those moving from the three Oregon counties to Clark County was substantially higher than those migrating in the other direction. For example, those that moved out of Clark County, Washington, to one of the three Oregon counties in the year 2000 reported an average adjusted gross income of $46,470 on their 2000 federal tax returns. However, those that left the three counties of Oregon and moved to Clark County reported an average adjusted gross income 52% higher, $70,463. In that year, the net value of income moving from Oregon to Washington was $150 million. And over a period of time, the average was 37% more for people moving towards Washington, and that resulted in a $1.3 billion loss of income towards Clark County between 1992 and 1996. And it's very difficult to track these individuals after they move the first year, so the study only looks at the first year. But I've talked to a lot of CPAs, wealth advisors, tax attorneys about the behavior of folks once they do move, and they suggest that most of the time they don't come back, and if they do, they stay for at least 3 years, a substantial period of time. And so I think if we could calculate that, which is very difficult to do, the number would be significantly higher. The pertinent question is, so what? We're losing wealthy people because of a strong incentive created by a tax differential of 9 to 11% and 0%. We still earn significant resources from our capital gains tax, which we invest in the health, education, and public safety of our citizens. The problem, which you've heard earlier, is that we're losing people who are angel investors and startup companies that provide management experience to these companies or that actually start new companies. They're people who invest in philanthropy. And we've only looked at migration from Oregon to Washington within the Portland metro area. There's a significant number of people who don't come to Oregon in the first place, who decide to come to the Northwest and choose Washington rather than Oregon, or that move from Oregon to another state entirely other than Washington. So, and when they leave, they don't just take their capital gains revenue, tax revenue. Oregon usually loses all of that tax revenue. So it's a significant problem that we've documented, and I think if we were able to add up the total impact of that loss, we probably would have already changed the tax policy to be more favorable to investment and wealth creation. Now, I want to be clear, there are a lot of factors that determine where people live and where businesses are successful and where investment is placed. There's a lot of reasons why Oregon's per capita income is probably below the national average. A few of those may be that we, compared to competitor states, have invested less of our tax dollars in higher education. We have an initiative system that has tied the hands of the legislature and driven costs up in certain parts of the budget. As Ms. Weiser said, circumstance certainly plays a large role. But tax policy is something we can control. Something that creates obvious incentives and distortions, and it's an area where Oregon is a clear outlier. So as it stands now, the capital gains tax we have is creating brain and wealth drain in Oregon. It counts for some portion of our state's lower per capita income, and I commend this committee for considering bills to improve that situation, and I thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Reinhart.
Chair Berger, Chair Barnhart, Dave Reinhart, representing Public Affairs Council, representing Northwest Food Processors, the Oregon Metals Industry Council. I'd just like to briefly piggyback on what Jeremy noted in his in his testimony. And I'm really here to submit an article from what in a prior life we used to call the other Portland newspaper. It's from the Portland Tribune, and it's an October 2009 article which documents and talks about the steady stream of individuals, movers and shakers, titans, philanthropists who head over to Washington and Vancouver in particular. It puts names and faces on those who do the who are the migrators. Now you'll notice in the article when you see it that many proponents of Oregon's high capital gains rate poo-poo this migration and these individuals, saying that there aren't that many of them and they don't go over for that long. They come back to the state. I would submit, however, that Oregon simply can't afford the loss of these individuals by our own choices. I think if you look at them and you can read their names, they've created more jobs for Oregonians, they've done more for charities in Oregon, and done more for children in Oregon than any of the proponents of the high capital gains rate. And whether in this article they were called somehow immoral for doing this or un-Oregonian for doing this, regardless of what you think of their morals or ethics or their love for Oregon, I don't think we're so flush with cash today that we can afford to see this revenue loss. And if you're losing $500,000 a pop on these individuals who go over there, and that's a low estimate, that's $500,000 that could go for school teachers, state services of one kind or another, never mind the investment. And I thank you for your time today and would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for this panel? Thank you. Thank you all for coming. Is there anyone else out there who hasn't been able to speak on this subject who would like to? Going once, going twice. That said, thank you very, very much, all of you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2412, House Bill 3050, House Bill 3187, and House Bill 3221. Mr. Barnhart, Representative Barnhart.
Madam Chair, I move to suspend the rules to reopen Senate Bill 306 to allow Representative Wan to vote. His vote, regardless of what it is, will not change the outcome.
Representative Barnhart moves that the rules be suspended and we open Senate Bill 306 in order to allow Representative Wan to vote. Any objection? So ordered. We are opening the work session on Senate Bill 306. Representative Wan, how do you vote?
No.
Representative Wan votes no, and with that, we close the work session on Senate Bill 306, and we are closing today's Revenue Committee hearing. Thank you all very much.